Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. We finally got some off-season hot stove news with the signings of Chicago's two new-ish big offensive stars in Jeff Weiss and John Lithgow. Weiss returns to the team after being away for the 2023 season, and Lithgow coming over after spending three seasons with the New York Empire, the last two of which coming home with UFA championships. These are 2 6-foot-5, very dynamic, offensive, star-level players who figured a slot right in on Chicago's offense, which struggled mightily last season, finishing with the lowest offensive efficiency of any playoff team during the 2023 season. Now they get two big offensive playmakers. Cam, you're in the Central Division. What's your real top-of-the-dome take on Chicago getting two big stars like Lithgow and Weiss back in their rotation?
So, two things. Number one, I've talked about this on a previous episode, but I felt like one of their biggest issues last year, not the biggest issue, but a big issue they had, is they really didn't have that big deep threat. They added Sjogren last year, and he is a great cutter and can get open at will, but he is not the person that you're really relying on to just be that big force down the field that can stretch with not only their legs, but their height. And now you add two guys who can do it, John Lithgow and Jeff Weiss. I mean, both of them are huge bodies. It's the old adage in sports, you can't coach height. Right, you can coach skill, you can coach up speed and athleticism, but you cannot coach how tall you are. And adding two bodies that big, I mean, that creates some issues, especially if you have a team that defensively lacks some of that height. So I still think their biggest issue from last year is yet to be solved, but I'll get into that here as we continue talking about these two signings.
Yeah, you know, these are two players with championship weekend experience. Lithgow, of course, as I just mentioned, winning two titles with New York. Weiss appearing with Chicago in both 2021 and 2022 with the Union. He was a very dynamic playmaker for the Union, especially in 2022. He came out big in the championship game, opening with a big downfield sky and coverage against the Empire. He's one of those big performance type players when they need it most. And I think one of the things that's really impressed me about both Lithgow and Weiss is that they kind of came into the league notably for their size and receiving playmaking skills. But as they've evolved as players, they've obviously added a throwing dimension. And not only are they capable as far as like hybridized continuation throwers, getting in rhythm, finding a downfield look to another receiver, but also they can both play in the backfield as high volume passers. I mean, this last year in 2023 for Lithgow, you look back to the week 4 performance at Philadelphia, they were down Ryan Osgar, and yet Lithgow stepped up, completed 48 of 49 throws in a game that went to overtime, kind of operating as that fill in safety release, precision passer, again, as a 6'5" option from the backfield. And it got me thinking, too, you know, Weiss had a very similar performance at the end of the season 2022 in Madison. Chicago was down. I can't remember which exact players in that game, but it forced Jeff Weiss from his normal kind of rail operator, continuation thrower, big body downfield into more of a backfield distributor role. And he completed somewhere near 50 throws. It was a season high for him, and he was just such a cool, calm operator in an otherwise pretty raucous defensive game, as it usually is in Bree Stevens. And now Chicago gets to kind of play with both of these pieces in an offense that, I think, to your point about Sjogren, already had a few, I think, throwing options in it. You talk about Sjogren, I think, showcasing more distribution skills last year in his first season with Chicago than he ever did in Detroit, just sort of opening his game a little bit more. Jack Shanahan, who's a big body similar to Lithgow and Weiss, but kind of more of, I think, a thrower as a true persona in the offensive role that he occupies. Sam Kaminsky will be back. Nico Lake, I think, will be back as well. This is kind of a throwing heavy offense. And so you wonder if Lithgow and Weiss will get to showcase as much of that throwing repertoire that they've developed, or if they might kind of shift back into more of those natural receiving roles, again, using that size that they seemingly lacked outside of Shanahan last year. There's just going to be a lot more for Dave Woods and the rest of this Union coaching staff to work with after a season last year, where it just felt like they were just dealing with the void created from the departure of Pavel Yannis and most of their offensive core. I mean, Ross Barker was there in limited time, but it wasn't quite the same as the Ross Barker that had been like an all UFA level player for several seasons prior. It was a completely different feel for Chicago in 2023. And now there's kind of this explosiveness that's been added with this Lithion Weiss thing, where you and I were talking pre-show about, does this even make Chicago kind of a top five, six-ish cutting core with Sjogren, Weiss, Shanahan, Lithion now? I think that it's meriting discussion. I don't know if they're there quite yet, but there's, I mean, a lot of production to be had with this unit.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem Chicago has that they're still facing is that void left by Pavel. They were so disorganized in the backfield last year. Paul Arters played a lot at the beginning of the season. He was really playing out of position. Like, they had him playing kind of like a center handler, and that is not where Paul Arters is going to do his best work. I remember talking with you about this actually last year, and I believe the analogy was Paul Arters is like a sports car, and what Chicago's asking him to do is go pick up groceries. And it's, yeah, just like, that's not what your sports car is for, right? Your sports, yeah, car is for showing off, doing some cool things, not for just going back and forth to the grocery store. And that's essentially the role he was in, but it was kind of almost out of necessity. Like, who else was going to fill that void? Sam Kaminsky, I remember, wasn't available, I think, in our first matchup against them, which was their first game of the season. It's like, without Sam Kaminsky there, without Pavel Yannis there, who else do you put there? I mean, Paul Arters kind of just by default had to be there. And it was just so clear he was so uncomfortable and so not Paul Arters having to play in that position. So I'm really kind of interested to see, do they solve those issues in the handler space? Because right now, I mean, last year they were third worst in the league in huck percentage. Part of that was probably due to not having those bigger downfield threats. But let's just be honest, part of that's not having the throwers to make those accurate throws. I think they really need to get better in that space, because, you know, who you have cutting up field doesn't matter much if you're having trouble getting them the disc. I think right now, the way I see it, the way they're actually going to get better in the deep game isn't going to be from the handler space. It's going to be from these cutters throwing to each other. Jack Shanahan loves to come in, grab a disc, and just chuck it deep. The dude has full field range. I saw a play, actually, I think it just got posted or reposted recently by the UFA YouTube channel, of like a 70-yard flick to Nate Goff. It was actually against us. And, you know, he just throws it on a dime. And that was in not calm weather there. There was some pretty heavy winds that you could see impacting a lot of throws in that game, but nothing impacting that Jack Shanahan forehand right there. So I'd be really curious to see how that works. I think that's going to be their bread and butter if they want to improve their deep game, getting the disc to Jack Shanahan. Because while Lithio and Weiss are capable throwers deep, they aren't the high volume throwers. Like, we're not talking about like what we see with Alex Atkins and Quinn Feiner in Colorado, where those guys will, I sent a tweet out about this. They're just as likely to beat you deep with their legs as they are with their throws. Lithio and Weiss would much rather be beating you deep with their legs. So I will be curious to see if they can up that huck game. They were barely over 50% as a team last year. But regardless, it definitely adds an element, just that element of the threat of them going deep is going to put defenses more on their heels than they were last year, when it was just really just Sjogren was the only one really running up and down the field with any sort of consistency.
Well, and we've kind of talked a few times already on this show about the limitations of when you don't have a consistent deep game, or at least don't present that threat of it. You know, we've talked about it, I think, in terms of DC Breeze and sort of the ceiling that sometimes their offense runs into, where New York seemingly in these bigger games can almost settle in a bit against their offense and sort of anticipate blitzing the lane a little bit more because they know they're not going to take some of those deep looks. We've talked about it in terms of, obviously, with Chicago, just the lack of success, or a team like Oakland that becomes over-reliant on it. So you're swinging and missing. You're obviously, when you're landing these haymakers, you're having games like when they beat Colorado at home. But then you have, you know, what happened at the end of their season, where when it's not clicking, when games tighten up, when it's a playoff level environment and you can't get those big explosives, then the offense just kind of goes away. And I think to your point about Chicago, they just lacked any sort of consistency in either the small game, which had been so reliant on Pavel Giannis for five straight seasons that when he went away, there was just kind of this shadow, this imprint left of, well, we should sort of run it like this, but it doesn't quite operate like that. You know, I think they found some success with Ben Priest and Jake Steslicki, both back now in 2024 with the team and their second seasons with the Union, with them running a small ball game, especially around the red zone. Those two can get a lot of action going with their legs and just sort of getting very precise throws in small spaces across that goal line. But without that larger dimension of attacking beyond what you mentioned, a couple of Jack Shanahan deep bombs, there's not much for, I think, the offense to get creative with. And I think you saw what happened against, well, you guys in the first round of the playoffs, where you just kind of choked them out almost in the first quarter right away. I mean, I think it was 2-2 pretty early on. And then I think your defense went on almost like a 7-1 run by the time it got to the midpoint of the second quarter. I think it was 5.5 minutes left in the first quarter, and it was about tied. And then by the time there was like 9 minutes left in the second quarter, your defense had created like a 6-7 goal lead for your team. And it was just because Chicago couldn't really do anything beyond simple resets and trying to establish almost a 1-2-3 very ABC elementary sort of almost vert stack approach. And now you add Weiss and Lithiau. I mean, I think their ability as throwers, despite what you were saying about their limitations, maybe as long range, you know, some of their capacity from range, they're really good as that continuation level thrower. I mean, Lithiau last season for New York averaged 17 completions a game, 95.6%. Weiss in 2022 averaged 26 completions a game, 96%. Those are great numbers for downfield players. I feel like a lot of times that 92, 94% is pretty good for somebody who kind of has to take those riskier looks without all the volume to sort of pad some of those completion rate numbers. But 96% for both of them, and combined, they're averaging almost, you know, 40 completions a game. That's really impressive stuff, I think. 43 completions a game, I think, combined in their last two full seasons. You know, that's a huge stabilizing presence, again, to this Union offense that so needs that. I think they have good passers, but to what you and I have been talking about, there's something kind of lacking between the talent and the system that isn't fusing all the way together. I'm interested to see which members now of kind of that I want to use this lightly, like patchwork offense that they had assembled by the end of the season that they were using in the playoffs, of again like Kaminsky and also Priest and Steslicki, sometimes these players who almost spelled a lot on defense, like if some of those players will remain now that Lithiau and Weiss will be in rotation, or if they go back into more defensive focus roles. Like, I'm just interested to see kind of what Chicago does now with this increase in good personnel.
Yeah, I would really anticipate, I think we've already kind of nailed down what the cutting line's probably going to look like. It's going to be Shanahan, Sjogren, Weiss, and Lithiau. I'd be really shocked if it was anything but that, if all four are available.
Same.
And then in the backfield, that's where the questions are going to come. I think it's pretty safe to assume that Sam Kaminsky's going to remain there. They announced, you know, that he was re-signing. They put out a little highlight, you know, a little reel for him on Chicago Union Twitter, I saw. And it's really, yeah, who's going to be back there with him, though? There's been no mention of Paul Arters, which, as I said before, though, if Paul Arters is on the team, you really want him more in the cutting space anyways, because he is somebody who's so good, kind of like Jack Shanahan, who we talked about earlier. He is so good at getting the disc somewhere and then just putting it somewhere else. That's really where he shines.
I was thinking about this comp, and don't hate me, anyone, but like when he's on, when he's just slinging it, it reminds me so much of kind of what Orion Osgar adds as that continuation, working kind of out of the stack athletic playmaker who can create separation and beat you as a receiver. And so he gets a little bit of respect, gets a little bit of padding. But if he gets under and he's in rhythm and he catches and fires, it's just lights out from the forehand side. And that's what Arters provides when he's on in the Chicago offense. I mean, we saw it in 2021, his rookie season, and then I think pronouncedly in 2022, when he's just ripping it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think like, so I don't know. I'll be curious to see who they pair, you know, with Kaminsky, you know, the other two people who are back there with him, but regardless, they got better upfield. I mean, that's without a doubt. So they're definitely better at on some part of the field offensively. None of that can hurt. It can only improve things from where they were last year. I mean, a couple episodes ago, I had forgotten Chicago even made the playoffs. And we played against them because they were so forgettable as a team last year. Like,
they backed in too. They kind of got a few wins early. They got the big win against Minnesota early on in the season. And then I think they lost, like, what was it? Three of their last four, something like that.
They lost a game to Pittsburgh. They got crushed by Madison in their last regular season game.
They lost by 9 on the road to Minnesota in their second to last regular season game. Yeah. Had a 38 turnover performance. They were down a lot of offensive starters. I do remember that game now that I'm looking at it. But I mean, they were 6 of 35 on their offensive possessions at Minnesota on July 15th. That's got to be bottom 4 offensive performance for the season in the league last year.
Yeah, most likely. The big problem, like even against us, we played them 3 times, twice in the regular season, once in the playoffs. I think our average margin of victory against them was like 5 or 6 goals. None of the games were particularly close. The first one being the closest, which was the only game they had, like Nate Goff was there. I think Ross Barker might have been there for that. I wasn't there for that game, but I think Nate Goff and Ross Barker were there for that game. I think it was the only game Nate Goff actually played the whole season. So they had their top lineup basically of the season. And even in that game where we're up there minus me and they're up there, I think, with pretty much everyone, they were down pretty big. I think they got it back to within maybe 3 or 4 by the end of the game. But at one point, I think Alley Cats were up 6 or 7 goals. So none of the games were particularly close against us, and we were the second place finisher. It just shows the gap that there was between the top 2 teams and then where Chicago was. But it's also strange because they somehow were the only team to win up in Minnesota at Seafoam Stadium. So it's like the potential's there.
Their defense is still there last year. You know, they got good defensive play at some pretty key junctures. The victory that they got earlier in that weekend when they won at Madison, it was Andrew Sjogren's first victory as a pro. He broke his, I think it was 39 straight losses, all with Detroit before. Well, not all with Detroit. Excuse me. He had lost a couple with Chicago prior to that. But it was his first victory as a pro. I mean, they played good defense at Madison, albeit against the Radicals team that struggled offensively. But then they, you know, went and won at Seafoam Stadium, to your point. So I think the thing that I'm interested in, too, going back to Lithion Weiss, is that I think minus Pavel last season, it was pretty apparent that the initiating key of that offense was completely different, right? Like, they just had a different set of protocols on how to start every drive. Mm-hmm. And I think you really saw that amplified toward the end of the season when there wasn't really a sense of, okay, who are we really sort of keying in off of to start each of these drives? And one of the things that I really was impressed with the development of Lithia last year was how often New York used him out of dead disc scenarios, picking up on a sideline in a double team trap, coming out of a roller pull, again, like in sideline situations, sort of in the middle of the field, using his size to get out of sticky predicaments, and knowing how much that kind of strategy is used in the Central Division, I'm really keen on seeing if the Union can kind of, again, amplify Lithia's sort of physical traits and throwing skills and mental acumen to get out of those spots and sort of ameliorate some of the stickiness that I think really drag them down at the start of drives. I just anecdotally, I can think of so many times where Chicago's offense is yielding the disc within the shadow of their own goal line, you know, just giving a 20 yard field for a defense to convert with. And that just makes everything pudding, I think, for a lot of D lines right now. And you just can get that close and just know you can be patient to get that break score. Changes everything, as opposed to having to sort of get a little bit more aggressive in the open field. And so if they can find a little bit more of that stability utilizing Lithiau and maybe even Weiss too now with a little bit more, I think, confidence in him and almost need for him in that system, just something to think about. Maybe Shanahan too, like maybe they sort of learn from Lithiau too and just allow all their bigs to initiate with the disc on the mark. I don't know. It's just something that I'm interested to see develop.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Also, like, Lithiau's been kind of, like, if you really think about it, you think about the New York Empire offense the last 3 years, like, John Lithiau almost feels like a cherry on top. He's not, like, he's not the person you think of when you think of New York's
offense. Oh, yeah. No, I mean.
So it's like, I'll be curious to see, he's going to be taking on a completely different role on this team, I would assume, because I would think for an offense that struggled as much as them last year, they're going to lean on him a lot more than the Empire ever had to. So what does that look like for Lithiau? Does he continue to produce at a similar level? Like, do we continue to see similar completion percentage? Do we continue to see similar score numbers? Does he elevate? Like, do we see him kind of reach a level that maybe he never needed to reach? So we never saw him reach in New York, where he can be like the guy who takes over the game, because we spend so much time. The thing about New York is, if you're going to talk about someone taking over the game, you're going to get 8 or 9 players deep before you even about mentioning Lithiau.
Yeah. And it's just one of those things too, where he's to no fault of his own, very much benefited from getting the 5, 6, 7 matchup on any given line he's going to be on. His height and his skills definitely make him a threat. But when you've got Oscar, Jack Williams, I mean, even Charles Weinberg, Jeff Babbitt, the reigning MVP. There's just so much firepower to deal with. Lithiau would skew sometimes to just taking on whatever an opposing defense could kind of put on him. And obviously that's going to shift on Chicago. And I do think there's both examples. You know, you talk about 2021, his first season championship weekend. It felt like the big stage of the semifinals and finals might have gotten to him a little bit. But then in 2022, it felt like both Carolina and Chicago, both first in the semis against the Flyers and then in the finals against the Union, that both opposing teams kind of tried to make Lithiau the focal point, and he responded with a great championship weekend. I think he had one turnover and almost a dozen scores altogether by the end of the weekend. Like, he was fantastic sort of being that finisher for them. And then last year, he didn't make a mistake. He was in a very much downscaled role. He was coming back from an injury. but he just sort of slotted in. Now, to your point, he's going to take on a much more focused and, I think, volume-oriented role in this Union offense. And can he handle that? I don't know. Again, there's the Week 4 performance at Philly last year to kind of showcase that. But it's still within a New York offense that, even though it didn't have Ryan Osgar, so it, Ben Yacht, Jeff Babbitt, Jack Williams. It wasn't like they were out of options. So, yeah, it's going to be – and just different division too, different opponents. I think it'll be really interesting for somebody like Lithiau and Weiss too, is such knowledgeable players. Like, they seem to really understand their matchup. One of the things that impressed me most about Weiss in 2022 was just his ability to sort of either leverage his size or his speed – depending on the individual matchup that he was faced with. I feel like Lithiau is very much the same sort of person, where if he needs to be a thrower in a given environment, that's what he can do. If he needs to go downfield and score 7 goals in a given game, he can go do that. So mm-hmm. how will they kind of adapt to those roles now in the Central? We'll see. But I think that'll do it for our discussion on the Weiss and Lithiau signings. But with some other news around the league, as we're kind of getting more momentum heading towards April 26th in the opening poll of the 2024 UFA season, there has been a lot more roster movement. There hasn't been anything big as far as splashy signings, a lot of re-signings, couple of little interesting moves here and there. And so Cam and I were each going to take two of our own sort of players to focus on amidst all of the various roster assembling announcements. There will be a coming time in the not too distant future where we will hopefully have full rosters available and can really start putting our shoulder into more, I think, forward-looking analysis. But for right now, we're just kind of having to stand pat. But I'll let Cam get going first with his first sort of juicy signing. So, you know, we're both going to be talking about big names, obviously. Out in Seattle, they re-signed all UFA member last year, Garrett Martin, as well as the superstar Khalif Al-Salam, and returned a bunch of their offensive core. Salt Lake Shred have re-signed a majority of their roster that made a 2023 championship game appearance. DC has announced the re-signings of Rowan McDonald, Johnny Malks, some big-time team veterans. But, you know, these are sort of what we come to expect. So what we're going to try and do, I think, here is give a little bit of a take and a spin on signings that we think are particularly important for the 2024 season for a particular roster's construction. Without me getting more blabbery from that point, again, I'm going to let Cam take it over.
Sure. I'm going to be a little bit of a homer here to start because I am going to talk about some alley cat signings.
Please do.
And, you know, these have been like mentioned kind of in passing, I think, on a previous pod. But the signings of Jake Kinnev and Jack Havey, who were Detroit Mechanics players for the past 3 years, I think that's going to go under the radar for a lot of people because they're just going to look at it as two players from Detroit. Like, who cares? Detroit's been terrible. Like, why would we be excited about that? But I think there's a lot to be excited about. Even if you just want to look at what did they do specifically for Detroit? Well, last year, first off, Jake Kinnev was playing 25 points a game, which, like, if you want a benchmark for, like, what is a lot of points per game to play, 25 is a pretty good benchmark. I played 25 points per game in 2022, and that meant for me, which is similar for what Jake Kinnev did last year, is I played pretty much every offensive point the entire season. If we got broken, I went back out there and ran it back, you know, and played some defensive points in some crucial moments at end of quarters. And that's kind of what Jake Kinnev was for Detroit. Combined with Jack Havey, last year, they combined for 46 assists, 48 goals, and 12 blocks as O-line players, right? Kinnev actually had 11 of those blocks. If you want to talk individually on the defensive side, 11 blocks, especially for a guy who's playing a majority of his points on O-line, that's quite a bit. I think what I'm pairing this with is also the fact that we are losing a couple of players this year who have been really huge for us. Obviously, this hasn't been announced because it's not a signing, but Jake Fella and Jeremy Keisch, who were, you know, Jake Fella has been a huge player for Alley Cats for, gosh, what, since 2016, I think. And Jeremy Keisch really, he played with us in 2019 and then rejoined the team in 2022 and 2023 and became a huge piece in our O-line. Tim Held, our owner, actually joked after one of our games in 2022, after Jeremy had a particularly big game, said, "Hey, Cam, I think we found your replacement." So, and Jeremy is an incredible player who makes, and he is good for one to two just like insane catches every game. You know, he had a Sports Center top 10 play last year in that playoff game against Chicago. And that was maybe not even the most impressive catch he had in that game, if I'm being honest. So it's those guys are, you know, how do you replace guys like that produce like that? Well, Jake Kinnev is a guy who honestly, like, he's not Jeremy Keisch. They're different players. They don't bring exactly the same skill set, but they both kind of have that tall, lanky build. They both have good speed. They both can get blocks. So, like, we're bringing in a guy who has proven that he can do that in this league. Jack Havey is a name that maybe even less people know that name. He has in great speed, and he has been one of the top two or three players on that team, basically. If you look at the three players on that team that would probably be considered, they're like good players that people would know about, it's those two and Joe Cubitt. Like, and who was Joe Cubitt throwing, so, you know, a lot of these hucks to? Well, those dimes he was throwing were to a lot of times to Jack Havey, Jake Kinniff. Like, it's these guys. So I think they're going to be huge for us. I don't know. We have no clue where anyone's playing right now. We are ahead of a lot of teams in the fact that we've known our roster for a while now. We had tryouts in early January and we did it all in one weekend. So while some teams are still going through the tryout process, we're like 6 weeks removed from when we did our tryouts. And we're actually heading into our second super weekend of practices this weekend. It'll be my first time being able to go since I was moving into this house I'm now in the weekend we had our first one. But I'm excited to get out there with Jake and Jack and a lot of the other new pieces that we have. I think that they're going to be names that if people didn't know them before, I think playing with us on, you know, obviously we're going to be getting more wins than Detroit's been getting recently. And we hope to be contending for the top of our division, getting them some more airtime. People are going to know these names if they didn't already, if they pay attention to the UFA, because they're going to be showing up in highlight reels for us. They're going to be making big plays. I wouldn't be surprised to see one of them or both of them at some point during the season being almost like the player of the game for us. I think they have that kind of potential. So I'm really excited to see what they do for us. And I'm just really excited to have them as my teammates and not have to worry about playing against them anymore.
Yeah, I think they're going to be two really interesting additions to watch develop into whatever rotations they fit into on your team. You know, Havey has been kind of the fill-in piece after Shogren left last year in Detroit's offense of being the key point receiver. And I think if not catching the goal, then churning enough and creating enough, I think, route running and action on the field to set everything up for people around him. Obviously, they also had the rookie Carson Chamberlain, who made an all-UFA mention, as well as Daniel Robinson, another rookie who was really impressive for them last year. You know, Havey, Robinson, and Chamberlain all kind of taking over the production responsibilities from the receiving role of Shogren's departure. But I wanted to turn my attention to Kenev because I think that he connects so nicely with what we were just talking about with Weiss and Lithiau, a kind of larger framed, maybe prototypical receiver as he came onto the scene, but now going into his fourth season has really sort of matured into a hybrid player. He was one of just 10 players last year with over 3,000 yards receiving and 300 or more completions, sort of showcasing that hybridized talent, that ability to be both a threat as a catcher as well as a thrower. He finished with 26 assists, 31 goals, had multiple goals in 9 of his 11 starts. Again, just the consistency of his production. And just anecdotally from watching him, I really like the way in which he pressured as a receiver and kind of made his defender almost respond to him and then would utilize that to be a continuation thrower, to sort of finish plays with his arm as opposed to his playmaking. The first couple of seasons, he was obviously just kind of able to extend, make plays with his length up in the air. But last year, it felt a lot more speed separation and keeping his defender almost guessing as to what his positioning was going to be on the field. And I'm really interested to see what you guys can do with a person like that, particularly with Keisch's role vacated. You know, that was kind of the role that he occupied. And again, like, with Kenev's size, one of the things that Indy has lacked, I feel like, as a true option is sort of a larger playmaking receiver role. Keisch has obviously occupied that for you. They have you, who has caught a few goals in this league over your tenure in the UFA. But, you know, it's a lot of times I feel like you guys get line drive hucks. You have so much experience with the ability to play with each other that you don't have to strain with just boosting a long ball into maybe contested coverage. And while I don't think you're going to be pursuing that as a number one option, having somebody like Kenev and just an ability to go get is maybe something that I don't know that you guys have always possessed on offense. I mean, again, like I'm thinking back to maybe more Rick Gross in his prime and his ability to go get as an athletic playmaker downfield, but he's sort of even matured more into a throwing capacity. It feels like Kenev is going to kind of add an explosiveness or verticality to your guys' potential playmaking that is going to be really important as you have a road game at Colorado, a team that has a ton of size, have to play Minnesota, who has a defense, who has a lot of versatility and size. Like, Havy and Kenev, I think, are going to really, to your point, play key roles as you guys potentially make another playoff run.
Yeah, I think they will play really key roles. And, you know, they completion percentage-wise, they're a little lower than where we've been on our O-line, but you have to take into account that they're obviously running around on a system that just hasn't really worked for 70-something games. So, they're working with less talent around them when they were in Detroit. They're working with less, they also never had, a stable rotation of their offense. Like you said with us, right? Like, we've played together with each other for so long. We know each other so well. They have not been able to really enjoy something like that in Detroit, where so many players are coming in and out every year. You mentioned Daniel Robinson and Carson Chamberlain came in last year, and they were pretty good additions for them. So that's great, but they're new to the team, right? And they're trying to figure out how to integrate those guys in, how to work with them. They don't know exactly where everyone's going to be. One thing we pride ourselves on in Indianapolis too is the fact how much preseason practicing we do and how much practice throughout the season we do. We are doing weekly practices throughout the season, and we are getting together in pods. We are doing, I believe, since we actually have buys the first 2 weeks this season, I think we're actually squeezing in 5 super weekend practices. So we're getting 10 preseason practices on Saturdays and Sundays where we're spending lots of time together, not even just on the field, but off the field. And a lot of other teams don't really enjoy doing, like, they just don't do that. Like, they just don't have the time, or they're too spread out or whatever, but we find a way to make it work. So it'll be great. I mean, we've still got, over 2 months until we play our first game. So we have a lot of time to integrate all of our new pieces in and to see where things end up. But regardless of where they end up on a roster, what role they end up playing, they are definitely going to be they're going to be guys that I would assume would be in our top 20 every week. And they're going to be guys who are on the field a lot, making an impact. So excited to see what that impact looks like.
Yeah. And we still, to your point, have about 2 months left until the start of the 2024 season. I'm going to go out west for my first pick. It's a re-signing, nothing too flashy, but it was last year. And I'm talking about Salt Lake's Grant Linsley. Obviously, that was a monumental signing that had been in the works for a long time in the preseason last year. And I think it was only announced just with 3 weeks to go before the 2023 season. Been something, again, kind of known but not quite confirmed, because as we've talked about before, Grant Linsley at the end of 2022 during the club season suffered one of the more, I think, traumatic to watch injuries in this sport's history, and to have him even be able to come back to the field, let alone come back for a contender who almost kind of needed a person of his pedigree, his experience, his sort of gravitas that he provides to any roster, and to see him just step in and fulfill that role with no hesitation, it was really, I think, one of the more under talked about stories from last year. The ability to come back from such a cataclysmic head injury of all things in a part of his career where I think it would have been very understandable had he just elected to hang it up, go focus on his family, mature into his 30s, and not have to worry about the rigors of coming back into a high competitive level. And yet he just sort of stepped back onto the field for the shred last season and said, all right, I'll be the player you need to be in this system. And as the season progressed, stepped into a larger and larger role as Salt Lake pushed towards an eventual runner-up finish against an undefeated team and likely the greatest team that's ever existed in this league's history. And so I digress. Lindsley coming back for a second season in Salt Lake, I think is going to be really, really interesting to watch. Obviously, it wasn't the first season, but what's really got me intrigued about Lindsley in year two with the Shred is the way in which his volume, his usage picked up so heavily towards the end of the season. Now, obviously, at the beginning of the season, they're working him in part-time. There was a lot of reporting about how he was just coming in for sparse practicing. How it wasn't until, I think, about week six in the season where he had fully moved out to Utah so he could be at weekly practices with the Shred. They had just sort of been relying on him and his abilities to that point to just plug in and be this smooth operator. And obviously Lindsley, of any player in the sports history, could probably do that as aptly as anybody. But to my point about how this upticked for him towards the end of the year, first seven games of his tenure with the Shred, averaged 19 completions, 155 yards a game. Very good precision numbers. I didn't calculate his passing rate, but it was near like 97-98%. And again, he's getting about, 15-20 touches a game. His last five starts, Lindsley is averaging 37 completions a game, over 300 total yards. And it just speaks to how Salt Lake really started to rely on him once they got into those deeper playoff matchups. Those couple of games against New York, his usage just went over the moon. This is a player who I think is very much, you should program that into what your team does in big games, is get Grant Lindsley the disc. And yet at the same time, what I was talking to you about in the pre-show, it seemed like they started to over-rely on him a little bit, and what had sort of limited their offense towards the end of the season in 2022, and it just became the Jordan Kerr show, sort of started to creep up towards the end of 2023 when they were faced with the defenses of Minnesota and New York. And it sort of became the Jordan Kerr and Grant Lindsley show, where it felt like if Salt Lake's offense was going to really move the disc, they had to rely on the combination of Kerr and Lindsley. And obviously, again, this isn't to say that you don't want to get Grant Lindsley the disc in big games. That's absolutely what you want to do. But I do think for how Salt Lake's offense functions in its hypothetically peak state, they want to keep those touches, I think, to 15 to 20. They want to make him more of a system player who is taking very high difficulty looks, maybe more red zone opportunity, but he's not becoming the absolute backbone. He's not at this point in his career being tasked with, 40, 50 touches a game. I feel like that's where Salt Lake becomes almost scared of being more of itself. Would you agree with that? Am I totally off base here? I'm not arguing against Grant Lindsley being with the disc, but to me, it felt like Salt Lake's offense was best when they were utilizing their 5, 6, 7 players on that line and not making it the top end focus of, we've got to make sure Kerr or Lindsley are sort of making the finishing touches on this drive.
I think Salt Lake's offense works a lot like ours in Indy, where the more you feel like everyone is getting their hands on the disc, the better you feel about how things are going. Because when they're just trying to force it to one person, or if one person just ends up getting the disc over and over again, what that means to me is that they're not able to get the disc to their first looks. They're having to wait until somebody gets open, instead of that next option just being open immediately. And here's the other thing, actually. When you look at the two defenses they faced at championship weekend, I have plenty of experience playing against Minnesota. Cutters are not the way you don't want to try to force the disc through your cutters to beat their defense. If you want to beat their defense, you actually have to have a lot of activity from your handlers. You need to be making sure your handlers are attacking downfield instead of just staying stationary in the backfield. We talked about this when we talked about the best defenses in the league. And Minnesota is just kind of happy to let you reset the disc as much as you want to. They're happy to let you lose yards to a wide open reset. What they don't want to do is allow easy looks up field. So another thing you notice, like if you look at the playoff numbers last year for Grant Linsley in terms of throwing, he was nearly 97% during the regular season, and that dropped to 93.5% in the playoffs. And that, I mean, almost 3.5% difference. I mean, that's a pretty big difference when you look at just efficiency numbers, and not to mention that he was throwing the disc a lot more. I think the sweet spot for most cutters in general, you don't want them getting over 30 throws in a game, honestly, because that means that that means a couple of things. One, any time you're getting up over 30 throws and it's not something you're doing consistently throughout the season, you're now being put in a situation that is a somewhat unnatural. But secondly, if you have a cutter making that many throws, that just tells me that you're stalling out in your drives and it's taking longer for you to punch the disc in. So that's not really what you want to see.
I think you saw that a lot of times with Salt Lake in that semifinals matchup, in particular with Minnesota. I remember they kept getting into those red zone opportunities. And mm-hmm. now while Salt Lake was an elite red zone offense, it felt, to your point, like they stalled out a bit. Like they would sort of get down and then they'd really have to work to get the disc across in order to finish those possessions.
Yeah, and if you want to look at why one of the reasons their red zone offense was so great last year, it's because so many times they were connecting to somebody who was in the red zone and it was all in the flow of the offense. So then it wasn't like they got to the red zone and then had to swing the disc around five or six times until they got a score. It was, you know, quick 15, 20 yard passes back to back to back. And next thing you know, you're hitting somebody who's just streaking into the end zone. And the person throwing it just happens to be within 20 yards of the end zone when they throw it. I think so many times we think of red zone offense, probably in our heads, we go to this space where, you know, the disc is stagnant somewhere in that 20 yard area and they're trying to figure out how to work around and beat the defense. But with Salt Lake, so much of their red zone offense was just that they were connecting cutter to cutter to cutter, and then it was in the end zone. So they were really working with somebody getting the disc and looking up, and we're really looking at a one-on-one matchup with no other people occupying that space. And really, when you get in that situation, which Salt Lake was great at last year, it is pretty easy to score because it is near impossible to play defense one-on-one on this wide of a field. And with the, you know, the caliber of throwers that Salt Lake has, even in their cutting space, like you're not going to win that matchup. So when you get them into the red zone, you actually make them have to stop, reset, set their offense up. You're going to be more successful. And Minnesota, to their credit, is really good at making sure that if you do connect upfield, they're pretty good about not letting you connect more than a couple of passes in a row before they kind of reset and kind of corral you back in. And then in New York, you know, in the New York game, they just have incredible one-on-one matchup defenders in the cutter space. So my biggest takeaway in that game was just how hard it was for not just Grant Linsley, but Jordan Kerr and the rest of that O-line just to get open downfield. Like I saw so many discs where they were, even when they did get it, it was like you almost kind of like tightened up a little bit because you felt like it was going to get D'd. So it was just like that weekend just proves like you can't force it through one player when you're playing against the best teams. You know, Grant Linsley and Jordan Kerr are going to go up against some of the, you know, the middle, the kind of maybe middle to lower tier teams. Those guys are just going to be open constantly, and they're going to be able to do whatever they want. But when they get to those bigger matchups, like I said, you don't want to see them throwing 35, 36 times, because that means we're stalling out on our drives. That means we're working really hard to punch the disc into the end zone. So that being said, Grant Linsley, I believe class of 07, like myself, repping the old guys in the league. What's up? So keep going, Grant. Like, we're holding it down. Funny story, and this is like, I never have, and I don't know if I ever will see myself as like a big deal. Like, it is starting to get kind of weird where these young guys are coming into the league and they'll be like, oh my gosh, like, you're Cameron Brock. And I'm like, yeah, what's your point? One of the funniest things, Grant Linsley is obviously a player I knew about and was like, man, this guy is amazing, incredible, world's player, like won UFA championships, like all these things, right? I see Brian Jones. I actually got lucky. I got to trade jerseys with Grant Linsley. I have an extensive UFA jersey collection. Grant Linsley is one of the ones. We traded full kits in 2019 when he was with New York. And one of the funniest things that I did not expect was Brian Jones coming up to me, who, of course, was the coach for that Empire team. And he goes, "You know, Grant wears your full Alley Cats kit to practice all the time." I was just like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, he shows up in the full green, like green Alley Cats, Cameron Brock jersey, green Alley Cats shorts all the time, like to pony practice, to Empire practice." I was like, he does not show up to pony practice. He's like, "No, seriously, he does." And I just thought that was so funny because to me, it's like, I felt like when I was putting on my Grant Lindsley jersey, I was like putting on my Superman jersey.
Yeah, right.
And like, here's Superman putting on Clark Kent's jersey, the way I looked at it. I was like, all right. I wonder if he's still repping it out there in Salt Lake. I'll have to, hopefully I get to, you know, meet him out there for championship week. And I guess I can ask him in person, but probably one of the funnier anecdotes I guess I have about Grant Lindsley or anyone in this league.
You know, this is probably a little not totally apropos, but like, what if he like doesn't wash it and it's just like, like what if like, yeah, he's wearing it to every practice, but somehow you're like Pavlovian association is just like, "Oh man, that Cam Brock jersey just is rank, man." And everyone's just slowly thinking like, "Cameron Brock stinks."
Oh, okay. Okay. Like, there it is.
They're just getting that bullied into their head over time as Grant's just like torching everyone at practice.
Yeah. It's starting to make sense.
We should ask Jordan Kerr if that tradition is still keeping up in Salt Lake. Yeah. One more thing before we get off Grant Lindsley as player, not as Cameron Brock fan, although I love that story, is, in year two, one of the things I'm interested to see develop, you know, he played 243 total points last year for the Shred. 209 of them were on offense, just 34 on defense. Will we maybe see a little bit more defensive quarterback Grant Lindsley for a Shred team that might be missing some of their offensive starters from last year? Just something to keep a watch on, as well as, and we talked about this a couple episodes ago, maybe just more offensive role time for Will Selfridge as he continues to grow and grow in this league. You know, obviously he made some outstanding defensive plays. He was marking up on Jack Williams in the championship game, got a hand block on him, doing the big finger wag, you know, never one to not celebrate. But, you know, just maybe a little bit more experimentation with that. I this is all just the guessings of, again, somebody who has a podcast and not a clipboard. That's all up for the reigning coach of the year, Bryce Merrill. But that's enough for me on Grant Lindsley. I wanted to kick it over to your second announcement or signings dissection post.
Sure. It was really hard to figure out where I wanted to go with this. There are a few, you mentioned earlier, Khalif El-Salam and Garrett Martin and kind of the re-signings of a lot of Seattle players. And I was thinking about going that direction because we have, like, I do think that is huge, but I feel like we've kind of touched on it a little bit already. My quick spiel on that is, like, Seattle hasn't been able to return their biggest players year after year after year. Like, they've had guys come on for a year, leave, and then they're kind of like left, like Manny Eckert comes to mind. Like, he came on and kind of was like kind of a force for them, and then he's gone, right? Like, they haven't been able to get those guys to like stay year after year. So the fact that they basically returned their whole O-line, you know, there's some things on the back burner, some players we potentially might be hearing about going to Seattle too that
we're waiting.
Maybe we'll be announced soon. But I think where I'm actually going to go, and this one I think probably flies way under the radar, but the fact that Brandon Van Dusen is coming back to LA, like, just, this isn't a new piece coming, but a person who I think is maybe honestly as underrated of a player as maybe we have in the league. And I say that as somebody who thinks that, you know, Brandon Van Dusen has, he was there pre-Pavel, obviously. And then him and Pavel paired together, I think, just gives so much stability to that O-line. And I think it's something that at the beginning of the year last year, we didn't see great things out of this LA offense. And we saw as the year went on, it kind of started to solidify a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, he is...
I would
Oh, go ahead.
To your point, I was just going to add the second half of their playoff win in Colorado. To me, that was just Van Dusen and Pavlyanis kind of converting O-line hold after O-line hold as Colorado sort of made a couple of attempts to come back. But I was talking about someone with somebody recently, about how the Summit just felt like, oh, of course they're going to come back in this game. Of course they're going to come back. And the Aviators O-line kept holding out. And to your point, yep, felt like Van Dusen and Giannis were the huge backbone and reason for that. That's all I wanted to add.
No, and I think, like, we talk about, like, what when you want to look at stats too, like, if you look at him as a thrower, like, and he, you know, he is a thrower, he is a handler, he's increased his throwing percentage each of the last 3 years. You know, he was 90% in 2021, up to 93, and then up to almost 96 last year. I mean, that is some pretty rapid growth. And not only that, but he did all that while increasing his amount of completions each year. So he's throwing more and completing at a higher clip. That is quite the adjustment as a thrower. I think probably adding Pavel and just having someone he knew he could rely on as like another handle, someone else in the handler space, obviously is going to be a big help to that. But then he even stepped his game up in the playoffs. He, increased his completion percentage in the playoffs, threw for over 1,000 yards in just 2 games played. I mean, that's some insane numbers. Not to mention, I mean, he was totaled almost 1,200 yards between the 2 games. I mean, 600 yards a game for a guy who's, you know, traditionally kind of known as just like somebody hanging out in the backfield. And he's beside Pavel, who, you know, is going to be taking a lot of those yards and a lot of those throws as well. Like, that just kind of speaks, I think, to his importance on that team. If they're going to continue to trend upward offensively, and I think having the unit kind of maybe stay together, like another year of Pavel being there and kind of another year of them playing together as a unit, if they can kind of keep the whole core together, I expect him to perform even better. I mean, he's still like pretty young. He's 24 years old. Like, he's kind of entering like that mid-20s prime where he should just continue to get better and better. So it'll be hard to top a, you know, basically 96% completion percentage and almost 4,500 yards of throwing. But the way he's been trending each year, I think he is prime for actually another jump in some regard. So I'll be really excited to see how he does, especially because LA was the third playoff team last year and there wasn't a lot of separation obviously between them and Oakland. I expect Seattle to be better this year, so I do expect it to be a bit of a dogfight out there for that third playoff spot. And he's going to have to be a big part of that if they're going to return to the playoffs this year.
Yeah, I mean, Van Dusen has been one of the more ascendant players the last, like, 2 seasons in particular. I mean, it is rookie season in 2021, 16 assists, 174 completions, 90% rate, 1,000-plus throwing yards. Season 2 in 2022, 46 assists, 455 completions, 93% completion rate, 3,888 throwing yards. This is the season before he got Pavel. Then last year, of course, with Pavel, assist numbers down a little bit, of course, as there is a little bit more love to share all around. Obviously, some other additions as well on O-line with Sean McDougal coming back. So 29 assists, down a little bit there. But to your point, 546 completions during the regular season, 95.96 completion percent rate, 4,450 throwing yardage total during the regular season and 11 starts. 31 hockey assists, just absolute grade A production numbers. And I think what really impressed me last season was his ability to ascend to a different level as far as like a playmaker and athlete. He had 17 goals during the regular season. He had just 12 combined in his first 2 seasons in this league. His receiving yardage numbers weren't quite as high. I feel like that's more just the wonkiness Daniel and I used to refer to it as like the Pavel padded 20 that you get off of like a centering pass. Like, yeah. Pavel gets 2,000 yards receiving every year. And while he's great inside the red zone, kind of mobilizing into a fullback, a lot of that is him taking a 20 and 30 yard centering pass at the beginning of each drive, just getting a chunk yardage gain as the defense is getting settled. I feel like Van Dusen had that taken away last year. So his receiving total numbers are down. But again, you look at the goals and just you look at how he's playing as a receiver. He is so authoritative now in one-on-one situations. And it just gives them another weapon to play with on an offense that I think is really starting to come into its own, as it was showing at the end of that season. I think the one thing I really want to see if they can improve on with LA and their offense, particularly Van Dusen and Giannis in the backfield, they're hucking. You talk about success rate on hucks. Van Dusen and Pavel combined for 26 completed hucks, and both of them were under 60% completion rate, which is just not, it's not high enough to sustain, I think, a championship level team, right? Like, you can't have your two biggest throwers completing under 60% in their long shots. And so can they get a little bit more precise in those looks? Do they dial it back? I think one of the more interesting things too is that while Van Dusen and Giannis are terrific range throwers when they want to be, it's really not their wheelhouse. I think they much prefer a lot more almost like Golti style small ball elements to their game. And so kind of how can they continue to adapt that?
Yeah, and it's funny too, because I would say that Van Dusen had better target. I mean, just having Sean McDougal automatically gave them a better target to throw to deep, I think, than what they were working with in years past.
And Everest Shapiro for full season two, he had his rookie season shortened with a season-ending injury, and last year he scored 34 goals.
That ankle injury.
Yeah.
I remember the still shot picture of that.
He rolled that bad boy bad. I feel like I did the same thing this last fall. It's not fun to do that. Luckily, he's way younger than I am.
But his huck completion percentage went down 12 points. It's kind of like, doesn't make any sense. Like, we add a better deep receiver and now. But, you know, part of the Pavel effect, I think, too, is you get so ingrained in this small ball that you just, like, you kind of get out of rhythm. Like, Van Dusen threw, you know, completed what, 7 less hucks? Like, they're just throwing less hucks too, because that's not the Pavel way. The Pavel way is not throw hucks from the backfield, at least. Like, when you think about the union teams that were like that 2022 union team, they were a really good hucking team percentage wise, but most of their hucks were coming from their cutters. Like, it was cutter to cutter throwing for deep scores. It was really, if you're in the backfield in that offense, it's more about facilitating movement and allowing you to get openings upfield for completions, and then allowing them to attack deep, which if you have the throwers, it's a way we've really done it in Indianapolis too. When you can get a cut where your cutter's comfortable throwing deep, you're throwing deep with less people down there, because obviously the disc is coming up from the backfield where you have two or three people plus two or three offenders, two or three defenders, and then you're getting it up to a cutter. Now you're only working with 6 total people basically that could possibly be in that deep space, as opposed to when you're throwing it from the backfield, there could be 10, 11, even 12 people up there. So it makes sense, but I to your point, like, they need to, if they are going to be hucking, they need to be doing it at a higher percentage. You'd really like, the number I kind of look at is 65%. Like, 65% or higher seems to be like, that's where you want your, especially your players who are throwing, you know, 15 to 20 or more hucks throughout the season. If they're not completing at least 65% of them, then they really need to maybe take a step back and not, and really be a little more choosy with their decision making. But we know about the West. In the West, it doesn't matter. We just throw the ball up and we just see what happens, right? You know?
Well, it's interesting that you compare it to Indy, because the other thing I think about there is that one of the things that LA does lack a little bit on their offense is size. And so throwing from the backfield, to your point about just how much more personnel you're going to have being able to respond downfield, isn't going to work out well for them. They should adapt something similar to what you guys have, where it's that continuation look. And to your point about 2022 Chicago, where you're kind of using those one-on-one connections downfield and trying to get isolated matchups that you like, as opposed to just letting hell fly from backfield. I mean, not everyone can have a Nethercutt initiated offense, an Austin Taylor, Bobby Lay, Atlanta offense, where you're just able to engage that deep look from a standstill. New York too, you know, you just plant Ryan Osgar and Jack Williams and Elliot Chartok too, at any point on the field and they can just rip that disc the full length. But
yeah, so let's move on though. Like, Brandon Van Dusen's great. He's going to be great again this year. I'm sure of it. Let's move on to our last person we're going to talk about. Who do you got as another signing that you think is a big deal that we need to be really looking at?
So I also had Khalif El-Salam and Garrett Martin, that kind of battery that formed last year for Seattle's offense. But I think we're going to have a lot more opportunity this preseason to still talk about the Cascades, so I'm going to put them aside. Then I also wanted to bring up honorable mentions, just going through Jake Cieslicki for Chicago. I just felt like his dual role on their offense and defense was so important last year. I really want to see again, as I mentioned earlier in this episode, where he sort of fits in for them this year, if he continues to sort of be a part of that backfield with Kaminsky and do a little bit more throw and go and maybe not focus on initiating their throwing depth from the backfield, but allowing the Weiss, Lithiao, Shanahans to sort of do it, as we were just talking about moments ago, making your deep looks come from that continuation cutting core. Cieslicki feels to be a big part of what Chicago does. As well as Carl Johnson for Pittsburgh. I just thought he really deserved consideration as a most improved player last year. He scored 50 goals and was the clear number two option alongside Max Shepard on the Pittsburgh offense last year. He has been on a meteoric rise. It'll be fun to see if he can continue that in his second season with the Thunderbirds. But who I settled on was, drumroll, undercard player, somebody who deserves, I think, kind of most overlooked accolades, Minnesota's Tristan Van DeMortel, a college champion back in the day with Ben Yacht, of all people, and Ryan Osgar with Minnesota Grey Duck way back when. So he's somebody with a lot of big game experience. He was second on the team last year in total completions with 402 for the windshield. And yet he almost split his points evenly between offense and defense. He averaged 11 offensive points per game, 9 defensive points. His scoring totals aren't crazy for the season. You know, 18 assists, 16 total goals. That averages about to 1.4 and 1.2 per game, respectively. But it's the efficiency numbers and the way he responded to just being thrown into almost every available role that they had that I think is going to be really quintessential for a windshield team that will be without some pretty key players. We even talked about before in the show, and it hasn't really been talked about in general because, again, our league struggles at talking about departures as opposed to just additions and signings. But from all reports that I'm hearing, Abe Coffin will not be returning to the windshield this season. That is obviously a huge, huge loss. The 2022 All-Star Game MVP, an all-defensive player in 2022. Last year, he missed a lot of time with a hip injury during the middle of the season. But when it came time for the clam bake at the end, he was nearly perfect in the semifinals game for the windshield. Again, Coffin will not be back with the team. So a player like Van DeMortel, who is used so much as a glue guy, as somebody who could step in and fulfill some pretty high volume, high utility roles in big games, will just become all the more important. Again, in the divisional final against Indianapolis, he had 4 completions and 2 yards while playing a majority of his time on defense. And then in the semifinal game, when Minnesota was without Josh Klein on offense, he switched into an offensive handler role and had 33 completions, almost 300 total yards, in a complete reversal of his role. And so I just think that that's a huge, huge, huge thing for Minnesota to have somebody with his kind of Swiss Army knife utility. He just gives them somebody to plug and play on both lines. That's kind of how Ben Feldman and that staff have been utilizing Minnesota so well. I figure that he will be a solution for them on offense, but he could spell time on both. What's your experience playing against Van DeMortel? He seems like just such a solid player, no matter where you place him.
Yeah, and I think, like, this is something else we've touched on in a previous episode, but, like, you really try to keep your O-lines pretty tight if you want to be successful in this league. And but what you always need is one or two guys that you can really rely on to come in and fill in any roles that are vacated by injuries or absences. And he was, I mean, he very clearly was that guy. We found out like just before game time. I mean, the Josh Klein scratch from the Salt Lake Shred game, it wasn't like they knew, at least reported, it wasn't reported until pretty close to game time. So
it was game time. He was, Klein was warming up. Like he was really trying to get going for that game.
So, I mean, the fact that literally at the drop of a hat, he just can go out there and plug in is great for them. And honestly, and the other thing is he's so different than Josh Klein as a player. Like they're like, that's the other thing. Like you could not almost get more polar opposite. Like Josh Klein has had the reputation of being a shooter since the first game he went out for the win show probably. And Tristan Van Martell could not be more opposite of that. And that's kind of like my impression of him is like, he's the guy, he's Pavel-esque in his like decision making, where it's just like he's going to take the easiest throw and complete it like pretty much every single time. You can't relying on him to make a mistake is not going to happen. Josh Klein, on the other hand, you can sometimes rely on him to take a shot maybe he shouldn't take, and maybe, you know, if you get him the disc, you know, a little bit more, he starts to get a little antsy and might throw one away. But Tristan Vandermortel, he's always going to find the right throw. He's always going to find the easy throw. He's never going to put the disc in harm's way. And they're having a person like that that you can just rely on to consistently make good decisions. It reminds me of a guy I played with in Indy for a long time, in Keenan Plew, when he was in our backfield. We knew that he was going to make the right decision with the disc pretty much every time he had it. And I kind of feel like that's what they have with Vandermortel, is just he's never going to put the disc in harm's way, and he's going to make sure at the very least that they keep possession. And that is one thing that Minnesota kind of struggled with last year. Offensively, they did have a tendency sometimes to just throw the disc away because they got too antsy. And he never turned into that. That was never something that he did. Abe Coffin, kind of the same way. Abe was not a person who he was a guy who seemingly made the right decision almost every time he had the disc in his hands. The biggest thing they're missing, though, as I assume he's going to slot into Abe's spot on offense, is Abe Coffin was such a difference maker because of how great of a deep thrower he was as well, especially if you left his back. I mean, you literally can't force backhand against a team that has Abe Coffin on the line. Like, you just cannot do it. I do not think there is a better backhand in Frisbee than Abe Coffin. And
I was just saying the 2019 South Division Championship game. That's all I wanted to say. He was literally perfect from the field because Carolina made Dallas go backhand throws, and it made Abe Coffin into a superstar in that game.
I listened to, I think it was Anthony Nunez has a great story about just like the most insane backhand he's ever seen in his life. Some throw from Abe that, you know, went, you know, the way they make it sound, it went 30 yards out of bounds and then it hit, you know, a receiver perfectly in stride in the end zone, you know. And I saw it firsthand when we were at the All-Star game in 2022. When you look at him winning the MVP, it was Abe Coffin backhand after backhand after backhand, just hitting people in stride. And this is with people he's not used to playing with, but it didn't even matter because he just puts the disc into such a great space where only his teammate is going to have a chance at it. That is not what you're going to get from Tristan Vandermortel. You are going to get the great decision-making, but he is not somebody that you're scared of like really beating you deep down the field with his throwing. So if there is like a caveat to like, I think this is great for them, and I think for their offense, they need somebody like him. But he is very much who he is. He is going to be the person who's keeping the disc really probably most of the time within 20 yards of where he's at. He's not going to be pushing the disc downfield, but he's going to be a consistently good decision maker. You can trust him with the disc in his hands. I mean, even deep in their own end zone, there were some times in that Salt Lake game where he was under pressure and he was deep in his like near his end zone, and he just finds the right throw. I mean, I don't know. I'll be interested to see what he does as a full-time offensive player, because I assume that's what he will be doing this year.
Yeah, and I don't know. He had a couple of really standout performances for them in key matchups. You know, we talked about Chicago beating Minnesota 16-12 in Chicago last year. The very next week, it was the rematch in Minnesota. Vandy Mortel was on offense in that game, 76-76 from the field, 4 assists, 2 goals. You talk about later in the season, they had a big matchup at Madison, basically to clinch the number one seed over you guys in the division, get a home field playoff game and a bye. Vandy Mortel had an assist, a goal, and a block, the block coming late in the game, and he was 39-40 from the field with his throws. You know, just somebody who can really be relied upon. We'll save a lot more discussion, obviously, in our coming episodes, as, again, we near closer and closer now, under 2 months till the start of the 2024 UFA season. But that will do it for this episode of Swing Pass. We will be back a week from now, hopefully with more of that percolating off-season signing news that Cam and I are really excited to share with you guys. We'll be talking to you soon, but that will do it for this week. Bye now.